We cannot officially convene, but we're all going to start, and then when everyone shows up, we'll do the official convening. Representative Murphy is going to start with her bill, 1990. That's when I graduated from high school.
I'm not going to tell you what I was doing in 1990.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 1990 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
We'll do the hearing first, and then we'll move it once everyone's here.
So, I'm here today to ask you to support the House File 1990, a surcharge for certified birth records established, funds appropriated to the Commissioner of Health. This is a simple bill that allows for money to be appropriated to the birth defect information system in Minnesota so that it can be carried out statewide. In 2004, the legislature passed language detailing the operation of a Minnesota birth defects information system in Minnesota state law. The birth defect information system is currently being implemented only in Hennepin and Ramsey counties. We would like to ensure that all Minnesota babies receive the benefits of this system. Therefore, we believe a statewide funding mechanism is critical to the success of the program. The primary goals of the birth defects prevention program are as follows. Monitor the incidence of birth defects and detect emerging health concerns and identify affected populations. To educate physicians and the public regarding birth defects, to ensure appropriate services are provided to affected families, to prevent birth defects through targeted education, and to stimulate research on risk factors, treatment, prevention, and the cure of birth defects. Better tracking of when and where birth defects occur and potential links to environmental and other factors will provide a critical information to help prevent them in the future. Without a system in place, the assessment of disease trends is very difficult, and the development of sound public health policy based on scientific data is nearly impossible. Here to speak in favor of the bill is Marianne Hewen, State Director of Programs and Public Affairs for the March of Dimes. Thank you.
Go ahead, Ms. Hewitt. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Marianne Hewen. I am the State Director of Programs and Public Affairs for the Minnesota Chapter March of Dimes. Thank you for this opportunity to present testimony today on behalf of the March of Dimes. Specifically, I come before you to ask for support of House File 1990, which would provide funding for a statewide birth defect information system. The mission of the March of Dimes is to improve the health of babies by preventing birth defects, premature birth, and infant mortality. Birth defects are the leading cause of infant death in this country, as well as a leading cause of childhood disability. It's estimated that 120,000 babies are born with a birth defect each year in the United States. This represents about 4% of all live births. And it's estimated that between 2,000 and 3,000 babies are born with birth defects in Minnesota every year. Iowa, North Dakota, and Wisconsin all have statewide birth defects programs. We believe Minnesota residents deserve the same as their neighboring states, if not better. Passage of House File 1990 would demonstrate continued support and commitment for funding to assure implementation and maintenance of the system. The birth defect information system, as was already said, is necessary to track the incidence of birth defects and identify communities and populations at higher risk. State-based birth defect systems help health officials evaluate needs, deliver services, implement, and evaluate prevention programs. Research into the causes of birth defects is a critical step in the development of cost-effective strategies to prevent birth defects. The ability to prevent birth defects saves both human and economic costs. In Minnesota, the total lifetime cost to care for all children born with spina bifida in a single year can approach $22 million. This is based on an average of 35 cases of spina bifida in Minnesota each year, multiplied by a lifetime cost of $630,000. So we urge you to protect communities throughout the state with the full funding of the birth defect system. The volunteers and staff of the March of Dimes will look forward to continued work with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hewen. Mr. Griffin, did you want to say something?
Mr. Chairman, Phil Griffin, representing the March of Dimes, is their lobbyist here in the Minnesota chapter. And, Mr. Chairman, we passed this bill based on federal funding that was available on a five-year grant that has been applied for and successfully received by the Department of Health. That grant was only enough money to provide services in the metropolitan area. And so we told you at the time that we passed that bill that we would be coming back to you, that was 2004, with a proposal to try and move this statewide. As you all know, the fiscal constraints that you are responding to this session are dire. We understand that, and it is a very, very difficult thing to do, but we think that this program needs to move forward. And so the funding source that we've identified is to try and tie this, although it may be somewhat a tangential tie to the birth certificate fee, and that's the funding mechanism that's used in this bill. Mr. Chairman, members, if there are questions, we'd be happy to go into them. We've also asked the Department of Health to be here today, the people that run the program. If there are detailed questions, we'd be happy to go into what we know and ask for their advice as well.
Yeah, I think we're probably going to have the department just come down and talk a little bit about the fee and whether it's going to cover it. But before that, are there questions from the members? Okay, why don't we have the department just say whether, yeah, it's great. It'll cover or some major concerns. You don't need all three. I think one of you guys could talk.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. My name is Craig Aikman. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota Department of Health. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name is Dan Simonic. I'm a unit supervisor in the Birth Effects Program.
And we'd be happy to answer specific questions about this proposal, or if you want just a general background on the birth effects information.
Why don't we just touch up on the fee a little bit, whether it's going to cover the program or not?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, I believe that a fiscal note was signed off regarding this proposal today, and I don't know if the committee has a copy of that or not. Okay. In essence, Mr. Chair, committee members, the proposal would generate approximately $3.1 million in fees by applying a $10 surcharge onto our existing birth certificate fee across the state. And actually, I would ask Barb Wills maybe to come to the table and help me kind of walk through this. Barb is our Assistant Director for Health Policy and is more familiar with the vital records program in the department.
Yeah, I think the page is going to get the fiscal note copied or something. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. As you know, this bill imposes a $10 surcharge on the sale.
Oh, ma'am, state your name for the record first.
I'm Barb Wills. I'm an Assistant Director for the Division of Health Policy, Minnesota Department of Health. This bill imposes a $10 surcharge on the sale of birth records to fund the Minnesota Birth Defects Information System. Certified birth records are sold to the state office and also at 110 local government offices throughout Minnesota, most often the county recorder's office. Because these offices are connected to the state system but are run independently, considerable planning and training would be necessary to handle the transition from one fee to another consistent and simultaneously so that proper fees are charged and collected starting on the same day. For example, we would need to inform the public about the fee increase well in advance because we know there will be issues with mailed-in applications for birth records that use outdated forms and do not have sufficient fees. These must be returned to the applicant. There are costs to local government. We were roughly estimating these at $170 per office, which would amount to approximately $19,000. Currently, $13 of a $16 birth certificate fee goes to fund the vital records system. An additional $3 surcharge goes to the Children's Trust Fund to prevent child abuse. So adding another $10 surcharge brings the cost of a birth record to $26, with half of the fee dedicated to non-vital records-related activities. In addition, this surcharge would make the fee for birth records in Minnesota considerably more expensive than our neighboring states.
Okay. Representative Eblis?
Just asked that. Mr. Akam, this wasn't part of the governor's budget, I presume, huh?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eblis, that's correct.
And is the, some of the, I'm just trying to help, I like this group and I think they do great work, and I'm just concerned that they may have found a money source that might not have the aeronautical capacity that they were hoping for, but do you want to comment on that? Is this, is the governor open to good deeds through fees like this, do you think, this year? Mr. Akam?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, you know, the current vital records fee for birth certificates is included, that a fee sunset is being abolished to continue the funding for a variety of work that we do currently to administer the birth records program. And so that is included in the governor's budget, and that is an ongoing cost to administer that program. As Ms. Wills actually said, also currently $3 of the existing fee does go to another purpose, a child abuse trust fund that's administered through the Department of Health Services. You know, I wouldn't be able to speak for the governor in regards to his feelings on using this as a vehicle for funding BDIS. But, you know, I would say that, you know, the birth defects program at the department, funded currently through federal sources, is an important program to us, and, you know, we certainly support that work. We would, you know, I don't think that we could stand here today and support this funding for sure.
Before we go, I just want to note that we do have a quorum with the new member walking in, and we're officially convening, and Representative Murphy moves that House File 1990, and it's going to be laid over for hospital inclusion. So, Representative Eblis.
Thanks, and just one more question. If you, for instance, they increased the fee on the newborn screening test, which would be more directly related, how much would that have to be to kind of get the same kind of money?
Mr. Eblis.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I don't know the answer to that question off the top of my head. Currently, the newborn screening blood test fee supports an additional program as well. The department screens newborn hearing as part of that fee. There's also another bill, I believe, that Representative Murphy has before us to increase the fee for newborn screening to add more money to that program. To add this on top of that would certainly exacerbate that fee as well.
Trying to help you out.
Mr. Chair,
Murphy?
I do think that, you know, this is a demonstration of the pickle we find ourselves in when there are good policy purposes before us and poor revenue options when we face a deficit like this.
Right. I was told that, I know we don't have the fiscal note in front of us, there is a saving to the state with the fee increase, so Representative Gutwell.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Murphy. I understand your perspective, but I am curious about where we get the $10 from. And then my second question is, what data are we analyzing in this program? Why are we doing $10? Why isn't it $5 or $3 or $2?
Mr. Griffith?
Mr. Chairman, Phil Griffin, again, with the March of Dimes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Gottwald, we have an actuary program over at one of my other clients. It's called the Phil Griffin School of Actuaries, and that's about the same place that this fee came from. We picked it out of the air trying to figure out what we thought the program meant, and so we had been waiting for the fiscal note. We just received a letter from department staff last Thursday that indicated that we may be a little bit high in terms of that fee. So as the committee looks at this, and from what I'm understanding, we may be able to lower that fairly dramatically.
I think we'll keep it.
Mr. Chairman, you're certainly free to use it in other ways.
Representative Gottwald.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the second part of my question about what exactly are we doing under this? What data are we analyzing? I hate to raise the issue again, but is this involving the blood spots, or what data are we analyzing? What materials are we analyzing?
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask if we could turn to Dan Simonic to give you a little better description of that.
State your name for the record.
My name is Dan Simonic. I'm a supervisor in the birth defect program. Mr. Chairman, Representative, the way the data is collected for birth defects involves a review of the medical record. There are no biological samples collected at any time. We do active surveillance where an abstractor goes into the hospital, reviews the record, gathers the information, and that's how it works.
All right, Representative Keeper?
No.
Okay. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who this question is for, but I'm just wondering, for the Minnesota Birth Defects Information System, is the information gotten from parents with informed consent? Is it an opt-in, opt-out? How do parents that aren't interested in participating, what's the process that they need to do to either opt-in or opt-out?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have an opt-out process that was passed in the 2004 version of the legislation. When we receive information from hospitals, we then go in to verify that those cases meet fairly strict criteria for a birth defect. We use the national standards, and so not every case we review is included in the system. We're very careful to make sure that the ones that are going in actually meet the standards. Once it is verified that it meets those criteria, we send a letter to the parents that includes information on available services, background on the program, and it includes the opt-out form in that letter, and it explains to them that if they would like their identifying information removed, they just need to fill out that form and mail it back to us. Upon receipt of that form, we then go ahead and remove the identifying information out of the database and then send an acknowledgement letter back to the parents just so they know that what they asked for actually happened.
Thank you. I'm just kind of curious, what's the percentage of forms you get back that are opt-out? I'm curious. I'm just wondering if people actually read them and if they get it or...
Yeah, we began, Mr. Chairman, Representative, we began data collection in June of 2005, and as of last February, we've had 133 opt-outs, and that represents about 4% of the cases that we have put in. And we've actually even had a couple of parents call back and thought they were opting in, and we had to go ahead and put them back in the system that they kind of misunderstood. So we really do try and make sure the parents understand, you know, where the data is going and where it's coming in.
Representative Gutwell, and then we'll take a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We were just handed out here in committee the it looks like the fiscal note on this bill, and I. This just caught my eye under local government costs on page 3 of 4. A reimbursement rate of $100 for referred birth defects cases included in the budget, and this is intended to provide support for local agencies to ensure affected families are connected. So help me understand what the $100 per case is going for with local agencies. I haven't heard that until just now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, the $100 is that whenever a hospital identifies that a child that has a birth defect, we want to make sure that that family is connected to the proper local services for follow-up and case management and treatment options. The $100 is to facilitate the county's ability to do that extra work. But given that this is not a pilot, it would be a statewide program.
All right, very good. All right, the bill's laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Oh, she did. No, you don't want. Representative Norton? You start on time, so if you're late, you get down.
I actually was here, Mr. Chair. I had my back to you.
Oh, thank you.
I will move. The chair will move House File 984. Where is this going? To the fourth one?
Committee? To local government.
To the finance, I
the licensing committee.
I thought it was fourth lawn committee, but we'll take it to
licensing. To the finance.
So the chair moves that House File 984 is recommended pass and be returned to the finance.
Okay, Mr. Chair, please say so. I have before you a bill that I wish Amos was here to present, because this is a bill that's near and dear to his heart, and many of you have probably seen him over the years advocating for this bill or something like it. But this is a bill that has been a pilot project and actually has grown quite rapidly, and because of its success, we're asking that you approve what's before you today, which would have primary care providers at their teen and child checkup include a brief oral exam, a risk assessment, and an application of fluoride varnish. There is no fiscal note to this, and I just received it about 5 minutes ago. You're welcome to that. There aren't copies, I don't believe. But the language...
Mr. Chair, there's no fiscal note to this bill?
No.
Well, then let's just move it right now. I don't think we need to have a discussion in this.
Well, then I think that'll be fine.
All right, let's...
All right, that's...
it's a really good bill.
And we had a discussion in policy.
We did. Yeah. All right, the chair moves that House File 984 be recommended pass and be re-referred back to the Finance Committee. And from there, I'll get to the floor. So, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the ayes carry. Thank you, Representative.
And I do, just for those who didn't hear this before, there's peace in the valley with MMA and DHS, and everybody has signed off on it.
I think you should leave when you...
I saw something. I'll turn my back on you once more.
We're waiting for Representative Huntley, and so someone could tell a joke.
I could entertain you,
sir. Yeah. Representative Pepin has a joke. We still haven't moved the minutes. Representative Pepin will move the minutes. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the minutes are moved. Representative Huntley, you're on deck. You are up. You're on. The show's on. Representative Huntley moves House File 1454. What is this one? Oh, and it'll be laid over for possible inclusion.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And this is a bill that sets up a uniform formulary exception. Most insurance companies have a formulary of drugs that you have to order from first. And if you want to get outside that formulary, you need to apply for an exception to that. And I have with me today Dr. Terry Clark from FMDC, who will tell you what the problem is and how much paperwork is being done. I will say this bill does have a fiscal note.
Representative Huntley, before we move to the fiscal note, you have an amendment, I believe, right? The DE-2?
Okay, yes, Mr. Chair, I would move the DE-2 amendment, and what this amendment does is add the phrase uniform prior authorization. If you have drugs, you want to order a drug, there are two things that would inhibit which drug you can order. First is the insurance company may have a formulary, which you have to order drugs from that formulary or get permission to go outside the formulary. Second, they may just say for this particular drug, you have to have prior authorization. So what we're adding with this amendment is prior authorization. And the whole idea of this bill is to make all the insurance companies use the same form.
Got it. Representative Huntley moves the DE-2 to put in the shape that the author wants. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Representative Huntley just got done explaining the bill. You were talking about the fiscal note?
Yes, Mr. Chair. There's a $6,000 fiscal note, I assume from the Department of Health. And at the same time, I think Dr. Clark will explain to you how our spending $6,000 may save the medical system several million.
All right, Dr. Clark, state your name for the record, and you may proceed.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Karen Spark. I'm a physician at the Duluth Clinic. And one of my activities there is to provide medical oversight and assistance for nurses who deal with these formulary forms that come from the various insurance companies. Just to put this in perspective, we just in Duluth, we've got four nurses dealing with this every day. They process 1,000 of these requests a month. At our regional clinic in Hibbing, with only 10 doctors, they process about 100 of these forms per month. It takes a lot of time, and the problem that we have is not that there are formularies or the need to have exceptions, but rather the process that the drug that the insurance companies use in Minnesota, with one exception, is all based on paper forms that have to be filled out by hand and then faxed. It takes 15 to 20 minutes to do each one, and it's extremely wasteful of time. The most ludicrous part of this is that the nurses are pulling information off of our electronic medical record system that costs millions in order to fill out a form by hand and then fax it. So that in the revised bill, we've added prior authorization as well as formulary exception, as well as Medicare Part D plans, because they all have in common the fact that they are processed with paper and fax, which is so inefficient. We believe that the cost, by the way, there are at least three national insurance plans that do all this on the internet with a website. It takes about 3 minutes to fill out those forms and send them on their way. We believe that we could cut our costs from about $500,000 a year to well below half of that. And that's just for SMDC. Realize that this is going on in every doctor's office, every large or small clinic all over the state. What the total cost is, I can only imagine. But with the fax methodology, it's got to be clumsy also at the insurance company end. As these requests come in and have to be processed, they decide whether or not they will approve or not approve a request. And believe it or not, they don't email us an answer. They fax it back, and it goes on and on. So the goal here is to provide simplification, standardization, and efficiency, and we think the savings will be significant. The bill also, or the amendment also provides for one small change. The policy committee set a deadline of July 1st for revision of the paper forms that the insurance companies have. That was the amendment changes that from July 1st to simply 6 weeks from the time that the bill is actually enacted. It also provides that we'll live with paper forms and fax until January 1st of 2011, and by then all the insurance companies have to have this converted to a web-based internet form.
Representative Keaton? Thank you. So this is $6,000. And it's going to save you, what, $50,000?
No. Just for SMDC, it'll save us somewhere between $250,000 and $300,000.
Okay. I'm just wondering if the hospitals could get together and figure out a way to find the $6,000, and we could write that into the bill. And then we could send it right to the floor and start on your 6 weeks right now instead of waiting for a omnibus bill that may take 3 or 4 months.
I like it.
I was thinking, since...
Or just waive it, I don't know.
I was thinking, since the state could pay for the $6,000, all that saving, we could book it and just pay the doctors less.
That'd be fine.
I'm just kidding.
Mr. Chair, I was thinking maybe we could just pass the hat around the room here and we could come up with the $6,000.
All right, we're getting. All right. Hey, we got to go through the chair here now. All right. Representation.
So, well, I mean, I'm honestly, Mr. Chair, this is kind of a serious
proposal. Yeah, I think you're right.
I mean, it'll actually speed up, because if it's in the omnibus bill, you don't, and this could be, what, May at the earliest, and...
Well, I think if there's no objection, and maybe, Representative Hunley, what do you think? Because you could lay there, lay in your committee, and if you could work something out, you could send it to the floor by itself.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen, I certainly prefer to send it to the floor and get it on moving as fast as possible, and it has to go from here to the Finance Committee first, and maybe by that time we can figure out what to do about $6,000.
That sounds good to me.
Okay, we'll change the motion. There's someone who wants to testify, and we'll get that, and then we'll go to the question. Ms. Komet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Catherine Komet from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Let me assure you that we would like to come to an agreement on this issue because we recognize the importance of making this an electronic transaction, and it would just be simpler for both the providers as well as the health plan. So we agree with that. We've been working closely together with the folks from SMDC, myself, and my health plan. We were really close to an agreement at about 12:30 today. I have a slight wrinkle that developed, and so we don't have complete agreement, but we agree with the intent, and I think the idea of setting this aside for one day or until the next committee hearing or something and letting us continue to work this out so that we can send the right language to the floor and maybe find a way to address the fiscal note with the hospitals, I think that would be a good solution. I just want to make one other point. Right after I was done talking with Dr. Clark, I was approached by a staff person from DHS who wanted to talk to me about the addition of the language prior authorization. I'm not sure if that would have an additional fiscal impact for DHS. I can't speak for them, but there is somebody here if anyone wanted to hear comments from DHS.
Okay. Representative Thiessen, was your question to the point or?
No.
Okay. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Walls informed me that this bill could go directly to the floor even with the fiscal note as long as it's covered in the financial part of it's covered in the omnibus bill. Mr. Walls wants to correct what I said.
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, I believe that per House rules, if it has a cost, it would have to go through the proper channels of Ways and Means or Finance or wherever. But a bill can travel separately as long as we account for its cost against our target.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking again at the DE2 amendment, and I'm wondering why we lost the July 1 implementation piece. I notice it does say that the commissioner will develop a uniform form within 6 weeks of enactment, but there's no discipline to use the form or require them to use it. And I recall we had a fairly extensive discussion in policy about wanting to get that used just as soon as possible so they're at least able to use the uniform paper form, even if we can't go to the electronic form until 2011. Can you help me with that, Representative Huntley?
Representative Huntley?
It's my understanding, Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, that this was an attempt to actually speed it up, and that if we pass this off the floor before the final week of the session, or it might be that if we put it in the omnibus bill, to be blunt, that we might be in special session before that could be passed, and so this speeds it up.
Representative Gutler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Huntley, I understand what we're trying to do by speeding it up, but all it talks about is creating the form, not, if you look at the original bill language, it says Beginning July 1, 2009, all health care providers must submit requests for formulary exceptions to blah, blah, blah. So I'm wondering, we're creating the form in a much more timely manner, but we're not requiring its use. Is that an oversight, or was that intentional?
Okay.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, I think you are correct, and somehow this was not kept in the bill, so we could amend that, I suppose. Mr. Clark.
That certainly was not the intent to drop that out. Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, why don't we work, if we can, on a amendment here. Maybe some other people have questions, or we have other.
Yeah, I think questions. It looks like everyone is. Mr. Chung is probably working on it. Representative Dean, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Representative Rod.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if this was mentioned previously, just let me know. But Representative Huntley, in the fiscal note, 140 hours. Have you challenged the department on that 140 hours of staff time? To create an exception document that seems like an assumption that is rather interesting to me in terms of creating a PDF.
Representative Huntley?
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, I think it's a much larger expense than is realistic, but that's what they've given us, and somehow we have to live with that. I personally think that a couple of teenagers could have done the whole computer thing over the weekend.
Representative Broad.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Huntley. I've got one, but it seems like we might want to, the chairman, might want to talk with them a little bit more. That seems extremely excessive to me in terms of the amount. Maybe I don't understand the complexities, but that is a really large amount of staff.
Representative Broad, did you want the department to come in?
No, I don't think I need that, Mr. Okay. Chairman, but I do think it's important for us to challenge fiscal notes when we don't agree with them. And so I appreciate the chairman moving in that direction.
Very good. As soon as we get the amendments done, I think my intention is to move it to finance. And if we need to work something out, we still have time there, and then finance could bring to the floor when it's ready. So that, would speed up the process a little bit faster. And I assume maybe $6,000, the department could just absorb that. Representative Gatwa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll have Mr. Chun read the amendment, and then we'll offer that as a verbal amendment. Or should we offer it as a written? That way it gets some minutes.
Go ahead, Mr. Chun. Why don't Mr. Chun read it, and then we'll offer it.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would be page 1, line 10. And I guess we're amending the DE2 amendment. That's page 1, line 10, after the period, insert, upon development of the form, all health care providers must submit requests for prior authorization and formulary exceptions using the uniform form, comma, and all group purchasers must accept this form from health care providers. Just picking up language from the earlier bill.
Okay. Everyone got that? Mr. Chung has it down, but if they have questions. Representative Gottwald moves the oral amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed?
No. That changes the language of the original bill. The original bill was that they developed the form by that date, right? Oh, no, that's by 2011. No, okay, that's right. All right.
I'm motion carries.
Okay. So are the health plans okay with that?
I mean, they still have some concerns, which we'll try to deal with between now and I think their major concern is the Medicare question.
Okay, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe the health plans could just tell us what has to get fixed between now and finance.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's a federal problem. Catherine Schmidt again from the Council of Health Plans. Medicare Part D has a separate form, and we are in the process of attempting to put the Medicare Part D formulary exception form fields into this form so that they're all the same. Problem is, for Minnesota, under Medicare Part D, Minnesota is part of a region, and there are six other states besides Minnesota. So for those health plans that do Medicare Part D business in Minnesota, they would do this form, use this form that we're putting together, and then have a different form for the other six states that they operate in. That creates more administrative complexity, having to use two forms and that sort of thing. That's not a problem that you can solve here. I'm just letting you know that's a reality that we have to deal with because of the complexity of the federal system. Hmm. So we're going to work on that and try and figure out a way around it if we can. That I just learned today.
Okay. Rustin got one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before our testifier leaves the table, you understand what we did with this amendment. We're trying to take that, the form we're going to create within 6 weeks of enactment and require that it be used by that earlier date that we had talked about in the previous committee hearing. Are you still comfortable with that or not?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald. Actually, we had a conversation, several conversations earlier today, and we had talked about, and I think we had found agreement on going to an effect, a date of using the standardized form as of 7-1 of 09 versus the 6 weeks after enactment, and then going electronic on 1-1 of 2011. We'd also talked about separating that out to do a separate form for prior authorization, because that's another complexity with all of this, and a separate form for formulary exception. We had some agreement on that. Then this Medicare issue came about, and it was just too late to try to come up with some language. It was literally, you know, within the hour. So SMDC is moving forward with their amendment to do it 6 weeks after enactment. I will say we did have agreement to do it 7-1 of 09. You know, we've already done the lion's share of the work of developing this form. That work has been completed. It's not necessarily going to be the same thing that DHS is going to have to weigh in on this because we hadn't involved them in that process, but that's going to be part of this 6 weeks after enactment. So, you know, I guess it's we're getting closer and closer to July 1. I mean, ideally we'd prefer 7-1 of 09, but I think we could live with 6 weeks after.
Okay. Thiessen?
So I still don't understand why can't we just accept out the Medicare form?
Have an exception?
I mean, you're going to have two forms one way or another. You're going to have to deal with that complexity. Either we'll have two forms in Minnesota, or you'll have one Minnesota form and then another form for all the rest of the states.
That's right.
And so I don't see why that's in.
That's the question.
I'm puzzled by the concern that has been described. I see the Medicare forms every day. They're not different. There's one question that they have that has to do with whether the request for the drug is a standard request or an expedited request, meaning it has to get done in a day. That's it. That's the only thing that's different. And so I'm puzzled. I don't see this as a stumbling block unless all the other forms that I from Part B plans are in violation of federal law, which I seriously doubt.
Well, it looks like there's some minor detail that still has to be worked out, and I think as we move to the finance committee, that'll give us some time to do it. But from what I could tell, the committee is pretty supportive moving this forward. So, additional comments? All right. Representative Huntley changes motion that House File 1454 be recommended as amended. The recommended pass and we refer to Finance Committee. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried. And then we have the DHS MERC overview up next.
I think it's tired. She don't want to do it.
Okay. We're waiting for testify.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair?
Yes, Reston Pepin.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it the chair's job to make sure jokes are prepared in case we have wait for testifiers?
Yes, Reston Hunley, where are your jokes? See, that was the joke, and then they're ready.
I was wondering if anything happened to me on the way to work this morning.
Okay, Mr. Akam.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. My budget director, Barb Julek, is caught testifying downstairs in the Budget and Planning Commission meeting on the federal stimulus package, and she was actually going to give this presentation today, but you're stuck with me, and barring any more jokes Representative Huntley has no opportunity. So with me today is Marie Zimmerman from the Department of Human Services. We'd be happy to go through a quick overview of the MERC program, which stands for Medical Education and Research Costs. The spreadsheet that I believe all of you have gives an outline of the governor's proposal and the House proposal, which I believe Representative Huntley moved in this committee last week. And in essence, what the program does is it provides training funding to hospitals and clinics to provide for residency programs, training primarily for primary care providers across the state. And the program is funded largely by a carve-out from the state's Medicaid allotment, which we then match with additional dollars from the state cigarette sales tax. In essence, the funding comes into the Department of Human Services as a state Medicaid agency. They then provide that funding in a transfer over to the Department of Health, where we administer the program and distribute the dollars through a formula that is set in statute. And the formula recently underwent a revision 2 years ago, but it's based largely on the volume of Medicaid cases that a particular hospital or clinic administers throughout the year. If you look at the spreadsheets, though, basically what has happened is the governor has unallotted $38,000 from this program, $38 million. I'm off by a few zeros. Too many billions and trillions floating around these days. So $38 million in the current year as part of the state's unallotment process back in January. His proposal, his budget, would be in essence to buy back that cost, which you can see happens in fiscal year 10. But then the governor is actually recommending a $28 million reduction to the program as a one-time cut. And there's another issue that's going on with the MERC program that has to do with the waiver that we negotiate with the CMS. And that has to do with the fact that they have capped the amount of money available for this program at the current year's levels going out into the future. And so you can see a savings that would occur normally under the existing Medicaid waiver in fiscal years 10, 11, 12, and out into 13 basically because the current year, the year we're in, is the amount, the maximum amount that's allowed for Medicaid reimbursement for this program. And so the reason the governor is buying back the unallotments is to maintain that higher level in anticipation of the cap, and then basically taking the reduction at a later year so that it won't affect the future cap for the program. And so if you look at the rest of the spreadsheet, in essence, you can see that the resulting savings to the state amounts to almost $90 million, excuse me, by 2013. Is that right?
No, that's the annual.
Oh, that's the annual revenue.
But under the governor, Mr. Chair and members, under the governor's budget, the savings is the difference. It's about $56 million. It's the difference between the $10 million and the $66 million savings.
And so, Mr. Chair, what the House proposal recommends is basically to mirror the governor's proposal, but not allow the $28 million cut, one-time cut to the program. Because the cut is also matched with Medicaid dollars, the resulting cut is only about $18 million. It's the $28 million minus the PMAP. About $20 million effect one time to the hospital.
Questions from the page? Is that the presentation?
That's the presentation we were prepared to give today. So.
All right. Any questions from members? All right. Thank you. There's nothing else on the agenda, so meeting adjourned.